This is the Women's Consciousness Raising Hour. I'm Diane Trombley. It's 12 o'clock.
Red and yellow and pink and green, purple and orange and blue, I can sing a rainbow. Listen with your eyes, listen with your eyes, and sing everything you see. You can sing a rainbow, sing a rainbow, sing along with me.
Last week on this program, we heard a tape of a panel discussion on child custody and divorce. This week, we'll be talking with two women who are involved with helping divorce mothers who are going through child custody battles. Jennifer Fleming is with Women in Transition, and Mickey Weinstein is with Custody Action for Lesbian Mothers. About halfway through the program today, we're going to open up our phone lines, so I hope that some of you will call in with comments or questions for either Jennifer or Mickey. Hello.
Hello, Diane.
Both of you work with organizations that offer aid to women who are faced with custody battles during divorce. Could you tell us a little bit more about the services that are offered by each of your organizations? Jennifer, what's Women in Transition?
Well, Women in Transition is a resource program that provides emotional support and counseling of all sorts to women who are experiencing separation, divorce, child custody battles, who are being physically abused by either their husbands or their boyfriends. We run small emotional support groups that are structured in nature to help women figure out what their options are, where they're going. The groups are designed to promote the emotional independence of the women who come to us so that whatever decisions they make about their futures, whether it's to stay single or to remarry or whatever, are made from positions of emotional strength rather than weakness. We also provide survival counseling for abused women. We're also designing now emotional support structure to provide them with the emotional wherewithal to face the situations in which they find themselves. We do a lot of training and consultation and public speaking on marriage, divorce, the family. We have affiliated with the West Philadelphia Mental Health Consortium, partially funded by them this year. And through the consortium, we provide training for staff within mental health centers, acquainting them with sex biases in the delivery of mental health services to women, and acquainting them with the alternative models for working with women that we as an organization have developed.
What about these monthly open houses that you have?
Okay, we've just begun to schedule these. These are open houses for, at this point in time, abused women who are physically abused by their husbands or boyfriends. If there are women who are interested in attending an open house to deal with both the legal aspects and the emotional aspects of being an abused woman, we suggest that you call Women in Transition.
Mickey, tell us a little bit more about Custody Action for Lesbian Mothers. When was it founded?
Yes, Custody Action for Lesbian Mothers, the anagram for which is CALM, is a much more specialized thing than Women in Transition. Our interest and our concern is exclusively with lesbian mothers who are attempting to either achieve custody, retain custody, or assure visitation of their children, either during separation or through a divorce battle, or finally after the divorce is already completed. CALM began in October of 1974, and it grew, interestingly, out of the experience of one lesbian mother who found, when she went to court to fight for custody of her own two children, that the case law was entirely against her, that not only was it against her, but there was almost no record of lesbian mother cases.
And why was that, Mickey?
Why?
Yeah.
Two reasons. Number one, in family court, in any kind of child custody matter, judicial discretion holds. Frequently, it is the judge's discretion to have a case in chambers. Ordinarily, the judge will attempt to prevent a hearing, whatever the issues are, whether it's lesbianism or not. In addition to which, where there is homosexuality raised as an issue, the judge will feel, because he will have his own concerns and fears and biases, the judge will be concerned not to embarrass the families, not to harm the children. And so lesbian mother cases, above all, will be held in chambers, that is, in secret, and there is no record of them. Mm-hmm. Shall I go on and talk some more about what CALM does?
Yeah.
CALM is a litigation support service. That's precisely what we do. What we have done is to collect all the material which is available and not available nationwide on lesbian mothers, on lesbian mother cases, cases which are pending as well as cases which have already been litigated, and make that material available to attorneys so that it is a support service both for lesbian mothers and also for the attorneys of lesbian mothers.
Is this material easily available? In other words, did you have trouble finding out about these cases?
Yes, a lot of trouble finding it. It really took, I think, a whole year, year and a half, perhaps, to build up what we think must be the best library of laws and cases surrounding lesbian mothers. There are other groups, not unlike CALM, in other parts of the country. There is a Lesbian Mother National Defense Fund, which unfortunately doesn't have very many funds, but which does act as a kind of clearinghouse, and we're hoping that's out of Seattle, and we're hoping CALM will be a clearinghouse for the East Coast as well. There's also a group in New York, which is called Dykes and Tykes, which is primarily concerned, I think, with emotional counseling and support. CALM also does other kinds of things besides litigation support. We try to provide as much emotional, psychological counseling and support for the mother, and also for the mother and her lover as a couple.
Mm-hmm. Mickey, I know that you're a historian. Yeah. I think it might be interesting to learn a little bit more about how custody cases have been handled in the past and how this might have changed.
Well, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding about this whole business around custody. It's only been in the 20th century that women have been thought to be legitimate candidates for the custody of their children. All throughout history, children have been the property of men, just as wives were the property of men. And in England, not until the late 1830s did Parliament pass a Custody of Infants Act, which said that a mother might be considered for custody of her children under seven, but children over seven automatically went to the father.
Well, women weren't legal beings, were they, through much of history?
Well, that's right. Yeah, married women weren't.
Right.
Single women had certain kinds of rights, but married women were covert, you know, shrouded. Blackstone said a husband and wife are one person, and that person is the husband.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that the custom of a woman taking the husband's name upon marriage was an indication of the fact that she ceased to exist as a separate legal identity and, in fact, became an extension of her husband. And under American law, the history of the American legal system around marriage and divorce is just filled with dozens and dozens of discriminatory provisions regarding the status of, quote, husband and, quote, wife. Between which there was no equality whatsoever.
That's right. Through the early 19th century, until some of the state laws began to change, a man had absolute control over his children even after his death. That is, he could will his children to someone other than their own mother. He could appoint as guardians and such. But of course, one of the reasons that he would do that was if his wife should remarry, then the new husband would have absolute control. Mm-hmm. Just as a historical aside, if I may, it really doesn't have anything to do with this, but you know, until the 1860s, a man could sue his wife in tort, and she could be sentenced for up to 2 years in jail for refusing to sleep with him.
Mm-hmm. And another interesting, a couple of other interesting provisions, the doctrine of coverture, which provided that husbands were the sole owners of whatever property, earnings, or anything that the wives acquired during their lifetimes. And in fact, the wives, married women, did not even begin to own property in their own names until the mid-19th century. So, for example, a woman, because of that, a woman whose husband had told her that he would pay her, for example, to work in his business, and if he then did not pay her, she had no right to sue him for those wages that he had promised her. And a very interesting illustration of the courts and the system's inability to enforce the scant rights that she did have within marriage were illustrated as recently as in the 1950s, I don't remember the exact year, when a woman whose husband was making in excess of $50,000 a year petitioned the family court to force him to support her at a certain figure, because she had been living in a wooden shack with no running water, no heat, etc. And the court ruled for the husband, saying that as long as he was providing her with shelter and food and clothing, that she had no right to complain.
Wow. And when it comes to custody of children, this tradition really holds. Now, Americans have a tendency to think that when a husband and wife through divorce or separation go into court, that somehow the mother is automatically going to be given the children. And that is simply not true, particularly in recent years, but it has never been universally true. There is, among some judges, a kind of, you know, Mother's Day sentimentality that operates to the advantage of mothers who are trying to get their children.
When did that start? When did we notice the change from custody to the father to custody to the mother?
In the United States, in the 19-teens, mm-hmm. Is when you begin to see that. And it becomes very quickly a kind of tradition.
How did it start?
It's suppressive, really. I don't know how it started. I'm sorry.
Well, see, I think that it started with when divorce became more prevalent. And until that time, divorce was so rare, so that child custody, there never was any question. The children automatically went with the father, and women did not divorce. They just sort of left, and they were considered immoral, and et cetera, et cetera. But when divorce started really on the rise, there had to be other provisions for the children because the fathers didn't want the children. So then it became popular to start awarding the children to the mother, and during that, and in order to bolster up that tendency within the system, the whole romantic sort of myths about women and children and mothers and children began to be developed as reinforcement for the policy.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, let me ask you, we know that divorce is difficult for both husband and wife, but it always seems that the woman comes away with more psychological scars, guilt, isolation, feelings of inadequacy. Why is this?
Okay, I think that a lot of people ask us that question. They also ask it in the context of, well, why does women in transition just help women? Because men suffer through divorce also, which is true, they do suffer, but they suffer very differently. From day one, women are conditioned to believe that their goal and role in life is to serve men, that fulfillment and happiness and contentment will come through marriage and a family. As a result, many women tend to define themselves through marriage, that the marriage is their world, it's their whole life, it's their identity. When the marriage breaks down, they feel not only that the marriage has failed, but that they have failed. They have failed in the one thing that they were put on earth to do, which is to be a good wife and mother. So, feelings of inadequacy and guilt can be overwhelming. The lack of reinforcement and support from those around her, her family, her friends, the institutions, the therapists, the lawyers, all of whom are busy promoting marriage as the be-all and end-all of her existence, tends to leave her feeling inadequate at best, and in many situations desperately inferior and desperately incapable of coping.
Right.
If I may add to that, of course, the situation of the lesbian mother, of the lesbian woman who seeks a divorce, is doubly difficult. If a divorced woman is a pariah, then the lesbian is a total outcast, because she has not only failed in the roles that have been established for her, but she has also failed in her very identity as a woman, right. So that her burdens of guilt are that much stronger and heavier.
Right. Well, why do husbands who seemingly never took an interest in their children before suddenly want custody?
That's a good one. Okay, I think that a lot of custody battles take place not so much because men want their children, but because they want to punish their wives. Now, we hear a lot of criticism of female behavior during the divorce process, not only around children, the clutching mother syndrome around children, but also around economics, the greedy woman who's going to take the husband for every cent that he has. And I feel very strongly that once this society stops conditioning women to believe that marriage is going to protect them and take care of them, and starts conditioning them to believe that they must protect and take care of themselves, that you will see a severe decline in this kind of behavior. But until that time, women tend to define themselves through motherhood and through wifehood. Now, if a man knows that he's going to cause irreparable damage to his wife by taking the children away from her, or even just making it nasty enough for her to keep them, and he's the kind of man that's inclined to want to do something like that, it's a gold mine for him. So many men use the custody issue as a weapon in the battle with their wives. Some women use the issue also, and we encourage women when they call us to try and be as fair as they possibly can. And we try to help women who are victims of that clutching kind of desperation around their children to begin to define themselves in other ways so that their children and they are not damaged by that whole process.
With respect to the lesbian mother, Mickey, I think that this battle between husband and the mother is even more bitter oftentimes. The husband,
yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, it is. It seems to be a stunning blow to a man to find that not only has his wife left him, but that she has left him for another woman. And in this kind of situation, of course, the desire for revenge is frequently very great. And it may well be that he also shares some of society's homophobia towards homosexuals. He may be fearful for his children or whatever, but the experience of Calm has been that it's simple vindictiveness. Mm. Frequently, we will advise mothers who come to us one of two things. Number one, if you're separating from your husband and he doesn't know that you're a lesbian, then just kind of keep it quiet. I don't mean to lie, and certainly not to lie in court, but to just kind of keep it quiet, not be terribly public, and perhaps he will go away. Men have the mobility to do that. Or perhaps he'll remarry and forget about you and not want the remnants of his former marriage. That is sometimes works, but not very often.
So you both really recommend out-of-court settlements whenever possible?
Oh, always. The golden rule of lesbian mother cases is settle out of court. We consider ourselves to have, not to have failed, but to really be facing a difficult battle if we have to go to court. The prejudices of the courts are the prejudices of society, and perhaps even more so, the courts always 15, 20 years behind the rest of society. And nothing freaks out a judge more than to find that the woman in front of him is a lesbian. She may well be the first lesbian he has knowingly ever seen in his life. And in some of the cases which have been reported, there's even voyeurism amongst the judges who ask very personal questions, absolutely irrelevant questions of the women who are on the stand. But oh yes, stay out of court.
Let me add to that that goes for all women. In any kind of domestic dispute, the golden rule is to stay out of court. You will always make that better if you can negotiate some kind of private agreement, whether it's around children, property, support, whatever. You'll always make out better doing it privately than you will in court. The courts are overloaded, they're outdated, they're sexist, they're racist, so that as I mentioned before, the rights that women do have within marriage or as separated women are not enforced. So trying to get a decent support order that's enforceable out of a family court is many times just a fruitless effort and a waste of time. In fact, we often advise women that unless they anticipate that their husbands can support them at a much higher level than they could get from the welfare system, that they're better off on welfare, as terrible as that is, because at least they know the check will come. So when it comes to custody, women make the constant mistake of thinking that they're going to win because they're good mothers. They go into court without lawyers when their husbands have lawyers, which is a disastrous error. Anytime you're in a child custody battle, you must be well represented. The things that win in that court are not only the biases in terms of the double standard, the different morality that women need to have, the different well, I wouldn't even call it morality, but their lifestyles are challenged in a child custody battle. Not only those issues, but the issues of money and power are what determine who wins a child custody battle. Right and wrong has very little to do with it. If your husband is making $35,000 a year or $20,000 a year, and you're, you know, bopping along on your 8 or 9 or your 10, and he can hire somebody from an influential firm who goes out to lunch with the judge after your case has been heard, who has a lot of status and prestige, and you're hiring a guy who just got out of law school that nobody knows, who's the judge going to listen to? There's a brotherhood within the legal system and the legal profession, and there's a lot of mutual back scratching that goes on. So these realities must be dealt with. So stay out of court if you possibly can. If you end up in court, make sure that you use the system and whatever resources you have available to your best advantage.
Okay, but let's say, I'm sorry, go ahead, Nikki.
No, let's go ahead. Well, I was going to add to that maybe two things. First, if you are in a custody battle, if a woman is in a custody battle with a husband who has remarried, then she's in a very difficult bind, without any question, because the judge never recognizes that he is indeed not giving custody to the father, but he is giving custody to another woman, to the woman who is not the mother of these children, and who may in this situation only be agreeing to this because it's what her new husband wants. And really, I wish that lawyers who represent mothers, lesbian or straight mothers, would emphasize that in court, because you're not awarding custody to the father, and you're awarding custody to another woman who's going to be at home and taking care of the children. And if that's what it's going to be, then the natural mother should have the children if she wants the children.
All right, but let's say a woman does get dragged into court over a custody case. And we know that men are increasingly gaining custody of their children. Now, what are some of the prominent factors in the minds of judges and juries which favor men? Let's get specific about how this double standard works, the economic factors and so forth.
Now, ordinarily, you don't have a jury in family court. Oh. It will just be the judge. Now, the Joanne Risher case in Texas was settled by a jury at the plaintiff's request, that is, at the husband's request.
What's the background of that case?
The Risher case, yes, which is one of the few lesbian mother cases to really reach prominence, and which is getting now in appeal a lot of support from very establishment-type feminist groups like National Organization for Women. Mm-hmm. In the Risher case, Joanne Risher had two sons, who both of whom were teenaged, and a lover who had a daughter, and they lived in a lesbian family situation, the three children and the two women. Risher's husband sued for custody. The older son, who was by this time 17, indicated that he wanted to go to his father, and in that situation there wouldn't be any problem. The younger son, who was about 12 or 13, maybe 11, indicated that he wanted to stay with his mother. The lover's former husband testified for the women, saying that he felt that the home they provided for his child was a very good one and that he would not sue for custody. They apparently had a very stable, long-term relationship, which mirrored a traditional nuclear family situation. But she really didn't have a chance, despite the child's desire to stay with her. Because the whole emphasis was not on her ability as a mother, her proven competence as a mother, the continuity of her relationship with her son, or the son's own desire to stay with her. But instead, the plaintiff, the father's lawyers, emphasized her lesbianism and really played on the fears of the jury. And so the jury found for him, and the child was moved. It's going into appeal. It is, as I think, from what I've read, a clean case, in the sense that, you know, she has a job, she has a stable home situation, and so on, so that it may be reversed on appeal, but I don't know. We used to think if we could only get a lesbian mother case to the Supreme Court and really have an opinion that would stand for the whole country. The nature of the Supreme Court at the moment, however, I'm beginning to feel I hope we don't get a case to the Supreme Court.
Well, you know, the thing that strikes me, Mickey, when I listen to you describe this woman is that, God forbid that she should be an ordinary woman, you know, who might have a few failings or a few faults, you know, who might drink a little bit, or maybe she, you know, went to a therapist once in her life or whatever. I mean, she's got to be a superwoman to be able to be considered, to be a fit human being, to be with the child that she's raised and nourished and loved for 12 years.
Now, there has been a wonderful and very positive decision in this past summer in the state of Maine, where a judge of the Superior Court in Maine said, among other things, that in dealing with a lesbian environment, that you should only take into account whether or not it is stable and long-term and a loving environment. And he awarded children to a lesbian couple. That's one of the most important decisions that's come down. We have a case now, which we have just lost, a real heartbreaker, in which this woman was the perfect American mother. Girl Scout troop leader, she teaches parent effectiveness training. The father hadn't seen the children in years, had denied paternity of the second child, and hadn't seen that child for 3 or 4 years. He was in $5,000 in arrears on support, and the state attempted to force him, you know, the city, the county, to pay that, and I guess he decided it was cheaper to try and go for custody. Mm-hmm. He had remarried. We had two psychologists who testified that the younger child was frightened of him and should not be moved. He had indicated no interest in the children up until this time, and the children were both taken from her.
Oh, my goodness. Did the fact that he remarried and now had his own nuclear family have any effect?
That, I think, was probably one of the deciding things. And the judge would not consider separating the children. That's a heartbreaker. We're hoping to be able to go into appeal with that, but appeal is so expensive that even though we would have the support of other legal groups who would help us and provide lawyers and so on, just the cost of getting the testimony, the court record, would be several thousand dollars, and we're really racking our brains on how that kind of money can be raised.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to add to that, not only the creation of a new nuclear family, but the husband's mother often plays a central role in the awarding of children and custody battles. If it's going to be clear that his mother is available to take care of the children while he's at work, et cetera, then once again the natural mother is at a disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, you had mentioned that women who had, heaven forbid, ever been in therapy were at a real disadvantage, and this was always brought up in a case. Isn't there something about the fact that society allows a woman to go into therapy much more readily than a man, even if he's in just the same psychological situation? So there are, in fact, more women who have been in therapy.
Right. I think that there are so many things that are used against women in custody battles. Okay, first we have the issue of the husband having the economic issues. If he has a house in the suburbs with three bedrooms and he's refused to move out and she's got a one-bedroom apartment in the city, obviously he's going to get greater consideration when it comes to providing the healthiest, quote-unquote, environment for the child. Women, of course, are emotionally unstable. We all know that. That's been demonstrated. So if the woman has a history of breakdown or has been institutionalized or even just a long-term therapy history, then she's at another disadvantage. If the husband can, for example, bring witnesses to court to testify that they saw a man enter this woman's house in such and such a night, this is one situation where a lesbian might come out a little better. I don't know, but testify that they saw a man enter the house and not come out until the next morning. Well, that's, you know, she's in trouble with that kind of testimony. Oftentimes, husbands buy and pay witnesses in child custody battles. I know a woman whose members of her own family were bought off by the husband, were paid to testify against her in child custody battles. That's common. That's commonplace. It's not, it can happen to anybody. It's not some unusual quirk within our basically democratic social system, legal system. It happens all the time. If the husband has influence in the town or the community in which he lives, that's another strike against her. For example, suppose he's the president of the Lions Club or the Elks or whatever, and the judge knows him, or he knows people who know the judge, that kind of thing. Once again, she has another strike against her. So, as you can see, it is a big mistake for any woman to make the assumption that she's going to win because she's a good mother.
Right. Yeah. Along the same lines about mother's family testifying against her, that's very common in lesbian mother cases, where her own parents are startled and shocked and ashamed, and they will testify against her. I suppose that's one of the most startling and sad things that struck me when I became
talk about a psychological scar from a divorce.
Yes, yeah. Yes, a very heavy one. And of course, the lesbian mother is at an added disadvantage. If she has a lover, we advise her not to live with her lover if she's going to go into court. Sometimes judges, and we've had this situation, judges will award custody to the mother with the understanding that she will never show herself as a lesbian to her children, not bring a lover into the home, certainly not live with one, be in effect a Saturday night lesbian when the children won't be aware of it. Which means that the very simple friendship, support, warmth of another person that everybody comes to depend on is closed to the lesbian mother. In addition to which, another thing that we do too, it's terrible to have to give in to the system over and over, but it's the women that we're concerned for. We